Volume 2, Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, presents session number 311. How Joseph Smith found 30 women to become his plural wives and how this changed his life. A paper presented by George D. Smith, with a response by Todd M. Compton.
His plural wives and how this changed his life. And I imagine that would change the life of anybody with 30 wives. We're glad that you could be here this morning. I was just remarking to a friend, there's certainly a lot of sessions on plural marriage this time, and of course that's my very favorite subject. But we're glad to have George Smith here to present this paper. Mr. Smith, or Brother Smith, is the co-founder of Signature Books. He lives in San Francisco with his wife, and he also edited the journals of William Clayton. Has presented several papers at Sunstone before on various subjects of Mormon history. The respondent is Todd Compton, author of In Sacred Loneliness, and he was got his doctorate at UCLA. I remember when his book came out, In Sacred Loneliness, about the wives of Joseph Smith, and I worked for Benchmark Books, and we had the book, a stack of books on the counter. And during the course of the first few weeks that it was out, many good Mormon families and individuals came in and saw that book. And they said, well, what's that about? And we would say, well, it's about 33 wives of Joseph Smith. And they got this shocked look on their face. You mean Joseph Smith really lived for a marriage? And these were long-term, born-in-the-church Mormons. And so I think it's time that this kind of came out and we discussed a little bit and recognized the fact that he indeed had many wives. It wasn't Brigham Young that started the principle of plural marriage. So, with that introduction, we'll turn the time over to George.
You just gave my presentation there.
That's about it. Well, I'm married actually to one wife. I have five children. They didn't go into all that. And frankly, I can't imagine tracking down and convincing 30 intelligent women to hook up with me in some kind of multiple household. I'm just thinking about it, trying to empathize was really the motive for this particular presentation. And I have to give a lot of credit to that individual who was able to do that. I'm not talking about the religious reasons, but just the man to woman. How do you go up and say, would you like to be my wife 30 times and be successful? And a few times unsuccessful, I understand. Interestingly enough, plural marriage, Mormon plural marriage, preceded the Mormon Church. I think that's kind of important to have in mind. It was in the ground before the church was formed in 1830. And the first known mention of plural marriage among the Latter-day Saints is, of course, in the Book of Mormon. It's a passage that forbidding plural marriage to migrant Hebrew peoples in the period of time 500 to 600 BC. And it reads, "There shall not any man among you have, save it be one wife, unless," and there's an unless, and this prescription is followed by a conditional future justification. "For if I will, saith the Lord of hosts, raise up seed unto me, I will command my people to marry polygamously and produce numerous children of the faith." This is Jacob 2:27-30. So whereas plural marriage is prohibited among these Book of Mormon peoples, at some future time, the voice of deity, as represented in this account, leaves the door open. Now, standing in juxtaposition to the prophet alluded to in the manuscript dictated, Smith in 1831, just 1 year after he published the Book of Mormon, sends 14 missionaries in Ohio, several of them married, and asks them to take Native American women as wives. Quote, "that their posterity may become white, delightsome, and just," which of course is an injunction that fulfills Book of Mormon prophecy. Now, there's no evidence that missionaries consummated plural marriage with Native American women in 1831 in Ohio, but the important point is the stage is set. The conditions to end the prohibition of multiple wives voiced in the Book of Mormon evidently are deemed to be fulfilled. Well, that wasn't very long. These passages are dictated in 1828, 1829. The book is published, the church is formed in 1830, and already in 1831, we're on the way to becoming a polygamous Mormon society. The prophet alluded to in the Book of Mormon appears in the person of the translator of the plates, and it will only be a matter of time before this author, prophet, translator, Joseph Smith, will initiate the practice of plural marriage and lead his followers in the fulfillment of all things. Now, this let's go right to the question, where did he find these women to marry? And this is kind of an interesting subject. There's some question whether or not he married Fanny Alger, which is someone he knew, and there's a fair record about her, probably around 1833 in Kirtland, Ohio. There's no official marriage record. Oliver Cowdery, who of course was one of the main translators of the, scribes of the plates that Joseph Smith dictated, was very upset with Smith's relationship to Fanny Alger, and he called it an affair, basically. Some people called it a marriage. So it's arguable. I think Todd comes down on the side of marriage. So does Michael Quinn. I think Larry Foster does not. I don't want to take a strong position. I feel personally she seems more understandable as the affair, but it doesn't really matter that much because she's one out of 30, and if there was a marriage in the 1830s, there probably wasn't more than one, and it's kind of questionable. But when plural marriage really got going was in Nauvoo, Illinois, for this reason. The Mormons were expelled, essentially left New York. They went to Ohio. There was a problem with the bank collapse and some sort of a questionable bank operation, 1837. There was a rebellion of church members. A lot of the original 12 apostles were excommunicated. Ohio sort of blew up 1838. The church then really moved to Missouri for a very brief and difficult period. The Mormons had been in Missouri, of course, in 1831, but in 1838 the headquarters was moved completely to Missouri, and there was an agreement the Mormons were to stay in Caldwell County and not be in other counties, but there was a mix-up and there was warfare between Missourians and Mormons. And in 1839, Joseph Smith had gotten out of jail, went to Illinois, acquired property, and that's where the church had its own country, its own theocracy. It had a very liberal charter with a lot of power, the Nauvoo Charter. And at that point, it was possible to practice plural marriage and to really run a theocracy. So this is where the marriage, the plural marriage history begins, really in 1841 in Nauvoo. It goes to 1844. Joseph Smith is killed, in large part due to plural marriage, opposition within and, of course, without the church. And then practiced aggressively in temple ceremonies just before crossing the plains west in 1846. So it's that 1840 period in Nauvoo that plural marriage is practiced by the LDS Church. However, it's that previous decade, the 1830s, largely in Kirtland and in other parts of Ohio, which is where Joseph Smith met most of his plural wives. So to trace this marital history between 1827 and 1841, after Joseph eloped with Emma, he was busy establishing a new church. And during the next few years after his marriage in 1827, he first demonstrates no noticeable romantic interest in other women. Well, it shouldn't be a surprise. That's a newly married guy, and I empathize with that. There is no suggestion that he planned to marry plural wives at that point. However, association with young daughters of convert families was something that did occur. And in retrospect, this appears to predict or pre-select his choice of plural wives some years later. Beginning in 1832, about 5 years after he had married Emma Hale, and about the time he began to write his personal history, both a history and began a diary, so 1832, the year of record keeping, he also developed several close relationships among these females who would afterwards become his plural wives. The years of Joseph Smith's marriage, the year of his marriage to Emma Hale, 1827, was also the time when the 21-year-old prophet might have come in contact with his forthcoming initial plural wife, Louisa Beeman. Again, that's 1841. But in 1827, she was 12 years old. It was in that year that Louisa's father, Livonian New York farmer Alva Beeman, helped the young Joseph hide plates, we are told. Parley P. Pratt observed that Smith and the Beemans knew each other, quote, long before the first organization of the church, and had assisted him to preserve the plates of the Book of Mormon from the enemy. Besides Emma, Louisa was perhaps the other one woman that Joseph had met through his endeavors with magic and treasure searching, which is, of course, how he did meet his wife, visiting in Pennsylvania with his father, and you know that story, perhaps. Louisa's father, Alva, used a divining rod and dug for treasure with the Smiths within the period 1822 to 27. It was in 1822 that Joseph, then age 17, discovered his first seer stone in Isaac Chase's well. At that time, Louisa was 7 years old. It is not clear when young Joseph met Louisa, but he most likely knew her by 1827, when the two families were collaborating on how to keep the highly charged story of unearthed buried treasure away from curious onlookers, and they were curious and aggressive. Some of these were Smith's former digging partners. It is even possible that Joseph met Louisa Beeman before his first wife, Emma Hale. In the first 3 years of marriage to Emma, from 1827 to 30, of course, Joseph was preoccupied by eluding his pursuers, recording ancient records of the Book of Mormon manuscript, which he published in March of 1830, and also gathering a following and forming his restored church. But during that year, he sent missionaries from western New York State into Ohio, and on January 2nd, 1831, he announced a revelation which ordered everyone to sell their wares and move 300 miles west to Kirtland, Ohio. And, of course, that is where he became acquainted with young women who, a decade later, would be sealed to him in plural marriage. These young women that Joseph met in the 1830s mostly ranged from 3 to 4 years old to their 20s, 30s, and 40s when first introduced to the confident young man who had spoken with angels and had just founded the true restored church. To start out, in November 1830, Mary Elizabeth Rollins, a pre-teenager, was baptized into the new Church of Christ by missionary Parley P. Pratt, a recently converted Campbellite preacher. The Rollins family had moved near Kirtland, Ohio, 2 years earlier. When Joseph and Emma arrived in Kirtland on February 1, 1831, right away they met two young girls who would later become the prophet's plural wives, Sarah Ann Whitney, aged 5, Mary Elizabeth Rollins, aged 12. Upon their arrival in Kirtland, the Smiths stopped by Newell K. Whitney's store and were invited to lodge with Whitney's partner, where the Rollins family lived. The space was too crowded, so they accepted an invitation from the Whitneys to move in with them. So he met both the Rollins and the Whitneys in association with a lodging need or acceptance. Both Sarah Ann Whitney and Mary Elizabeth Rollins, schoolgirls, were awed by the attentions of the 24-year-old prophet. When Mary Elizabeth met Smith, she apparently shared some intimacy with him. Years later, she commented that at that time she had felt sealed to him. As a young girl, she participated fervently in the new millennialist community in the fall of 1831 at age 13. She spoke in tongues at Mormon gatherings in Missouri. It was in 1834 in Kirtland that Smith later said he was commanded to marry this 16-year-old follower. The next year, she married Adam Leitner and became a mother at 18, although she remained close to Smith through the 1830s and would become one of his first plural wives early in 1842. A 6-year-old Sarah Ann Whitney would later engage in we might say a torrid romance with Smith, which is recorded in a still extant correspondence from the summer of 1842. Flora Ann Woodworth, another of Smith's plural wives who first encountered him as a young girl in the 1830s, was about 6 years old when her family met the Mormons in 1832 in Pennsylvania. In 1843, 16-year-old Flora would marry 37-year-old Smith. Nancy Winchester was aged 4 when her family was baptized in 1833. She would marry Smith a decade later at age 14 or 15. Helen Mar Kimball, who was born in Mendon, New York, about 10 miles east of Palmyra, was 3 years old when her father, Heber C. Kimball, was baptized a Mormon in 1832. In 1836, at age 7, she attended school next to the Smith home in Kirtland. With her father's permission, she would marry Smith just a few years later in Nauvoo at age 14. Helen Kimball and Nancy Winchester were Joseph Smith's youngest admirers and youngest wives. In 1837, while married to David Sessions, 42-year-old Patty Bartlett Sessions met Smith in Kirtland, as did their 18-year-old daughter Sylvia Porter Sessions. Although Sylvia married Windsor P. Lyon the next year, both mother and daughter would marry Smith 4 years afterwards. Almira Johnson was in her early 20s when she was baptized between 1831 and 1833. Her older sister, Delsina, knew Smith in 1835 in Ohio, where her husband, Lyman Sherman, became close friends with the prophet. Both sisters would marry Smith a few years later. At age 24, Agnes Kulbrick met Smith in 1832 when he visited Boston. Her first marriage, however, was to Joseph's younger brother, Don Carlos, in 1835. Don Carlos died in 1841, and soon after, Agnes became Joseph's wife. And as the story goes, of course, Joseph was killed in 1844. She married a third Smith, George A. Smith, and they weren't too close, and eventually she went west, married a fellow named Pickett, and she's married in, she's buried in Oakland, California, under the name Agnes Pickett. And her daughter Josephina, who was probably named after Joseph, went by Ina, and is buried next to her in an unmarked grave. I credit Todd Compton for searching this material out. Very interesting. If you're out in San Francisco or Oakland, that's worthwhile to follow. And I would check that story in Sacred Loneliness, Todd Compton's book. It's one of the very wonderful biographies that he gathered together. Fanny Young, older sister of Smith's successor Brigham Young, became converted in April 1840 after the family moved from Vermont to Mendon, New York. She married Smith in 1843. Elizabeth Davis and her husband were baptized in the Mormon faith in 1831 in Ohio. Elizabeth grew close to the prophet through the decade before she became one of his older plural wives in 1842. Hannah Ells was baptized at age 23 in about 1838. She met Smith 2 years later and married him in 1843. And so you can see the pattern, meeting in the 1830s and marrying in the 1840s. And that would be kind of a normal pattern for any of us if we met somebody and maybe, you know, either courted them or wrote letters or knew them for a few years and married them a little later. The interesting thing is there were 30 to 40 of these relationships which ended up in marriage. One of Smith's most respected wives, Eliza Snow, was aged 27 when she and her family met the Smiths in Ohio between 1831 and 1832. She became baptized in 1835 at 31. Eliza moved in with the Smiths a month and a half after she married Joseph in mid-1842. Now, one of the common bonds of meeting and eventually marrying is spending time under the same roof, which is a predictor of plural marriages years later. Many young women who had lived under the same roof with Smith years prior to having become his plural wives. Some stayed at one of his homes in Ohio, Missouri, or Illinois. For others, the Smiths had stayed at their family home, such as Sarah Ann Whitney, which we just discussed. In some instances, one or more of the parents of these young women had become ill and died, providing an opportunity for Joseph and Emma to express their generosity and invite them to reside in the Smith household, either as boarders or as young housekeepers. In 1834, Joseph Smith stayed at the Beeman household when he was 28 and Louisa was 19. He might have felt comfortable lodging in the with family friends from a prior decade when Louisa had been about 12. In 1837 and 1840, respectively, Louisa Beeman's father and mother died, and in 1840, Joseph Smith taught the principle of plural marriage to Louisa's brother-in-law, Joseph Noble, and Smith married Louisa the following year, with Noble saying the words. At age 15, Marinda Nancy Johnson met Joseph Smith in Ohio in 1831. She recalled that when he stared into her eyes, he had made her feel ashamed. Smith lived in the Johnson home during the years 1831 and 32, and September 4, 1833, Marinda married Orson Hyde, who in 2 years would become one of Smith's apostles. She remained close to the prophet up to the time of their marriage in 1842. In this case, and in some of the other marriages, the marriage partner was still married to a husband, a living husband, in the case of Orson Hyde, a member of the faith, and in this case, an apostle of the prophet. Martha McBride and her husband, Vincent Knight, housed Smith in their home in Ohio in 1834. Martha became Smith's plural wife in 1842. Lucinda Pendleton and her husband, George Harris, were baptized in 1834 after hearing Orson Pratt's message in Indiana. They joined the Mormons in Missouri by 1836, and 2 years later, when Smith went from Ohio to Missouri, he stayed with George and Lucinda for 2 months. At that time, Lucinda was aged 36. Joseph and Lucinda were so close during this period that polygamy scholar Todd Compton speculates whether or not a plural marriage might have taken place in 1838 while Lucinda's husband, George Harris, remained part of the threesome. When the Mormons migrated to Nauvoo in 1839, Smith invited Lucinda and George to live across the street from him. At some unspecified time, Lucinda did become one of the prophet's plural wives, most likely by 1842. Sarah Ann Kingsley met Joseph Smith in 1835 when she and her husband, John Cleveland, became converts in Ohio. The next year, they moved to Quincy, Illinois, and in 1839, Joseph and Emma stayed with the Clevelands on their way to Nauvoo. Sarah would marry Smith about 3 years later in mid-1842. When the Mormons migrated to Nauvoo in 1839, Smith established a residence which young women might stay if their families were experiencing instability. In 1835, William and Zina Huntington had converted to Mormonism in Ohio. The next year, they moved to Kirtland, where their 15-year-old daughter named Zina met Smith. That same year, their 25-year-old daughter, Priscindia, who had been married to Norman Buell since 1827, also met Smith. when the Huntingtons moved to Nauvoo, their mother died, and young Zina, with her father and some siblings, moved in with the Smith family for a few weeks of August 1839. Both Zina and Prescindia, each already married, agreed to become Smith's plural wives in 1841, still married. Although Smith had achieved some stability in the largely Mormon community of Nauvoo, when the sheriff attempted to arrest him, he again found the need to stay at his followers' households. So this is not moving per se, it's escaping the possibility of arrest. Ruth Daggett Voss was 25 when she met Smith in 1832. She was baptized in 1836. She and her husband Edwin Sayers housed Smith when he was in hiding from the sheriff in Nauvoo during August of 1842. Evidently, with her husband's acquiescence, she married the prophet sometime in February 1843. A year after the Huntington sisters moved in with the Smiths, two or more sets of sisters became residents in the Smith home. Eliza and Emily Partridge had lived near Kirtland, and their father would become baptized into the Mormon faith in 1830. At age 8, Emily followed her father into baptism in 1832. Now, so keep in mind that when you're 8 years old, 6 years old, 5 years old, your parents join a faith and you do, you're perhaps somewhat impressionable. And I think that's, of course, some of the women were older, so there's really a mix of circumstances. Did I say this? At age 8, Emily followed her father into baptism in 1832. Eliza was baptized in 1831. And in 1841, when Emily was 16 and Eliza was 20, they became housemaids in the Smith home. The sisters met Sarah and Maria Lawrence were aged 11 and 13, respectively, when Smith visited Canada in 1837 and converted their parents. 3 years later, after their father died, Smith took a guardian role toward the Lawrence sisters, and they lived in his home from 1841 to 42. Like the Huntington sisters, the Partridge sisters and Lawrence sisters each became Smith's plural wives. They married the prophet in 1843. We're getting toward the end of all these numbers of wives. It's a lot. Lucy Walker was age 6 when her father was baptized in 1832 in Kirtland. At age 15, she recalled meeting Smith in Nauvoo, and the next year served as a housemaid in the Smith home, a year before their marriage. At age 17, Elvira Annie Cowles lived near Palmyra, New York, when her family converted in 1830. She was baptized at age 22 in 1835, lived in the Smith household from 1840 to 1842. Elvira married Smith the next year. Desdemona Fulmer moved with her family from Pennsylvania to Ohio, was baptized at age 27 in 1836. In the spring of 1842, about a year before her marriage to Smith, she lived in the Smith household with Elvira Cowles and the Partridge sisters. So these women weren't really alone meeting the prophet, they were in groups. And after their marriage, they knew each other, and when Joseph Smith died and they remarried, say, Heber Kimball or Brigham Young, they often lived in groups as well. So the women became close associates. It was really an association of women who, in a serial way, married Joseph Smith and then collectively stayed together through sequences of marriages and, of course, migration westward. Melissa Lott, who also lived in Pennsylvania, was 9 years old when her family became converted to Mormonism in 1833. A decade later, at age 18, she lived in the Smith home a year before becoming his wife. So the acquaintances and intimate relationships throughout the 30s preceded and seemed to presage the plural marriages Smith would consummate in the 1840s. Early conversations with families and their daughters, some quite young, prepared the way for Smith to later invite maturing young women, many in their teens, some in their 20s, and a few older, to become his plural wives. Well, the second part of the title is How Did This Change His Life? And I think I mentioned in one respect it changed his life differently than polygamy changed the life of other Mormon followers of Joseph Smith. With the followers, especially after Nauvoo in Salt Lake, you might have one husband and several wives living in the same or adjacent homes. In the case of Joseph Smith, most of these women did not live in his home. Eliza Snow lived in the home for a while. The Partridge sisters for a while. In some cases, Emma expelled the women from the homes. But generally speaking, these were marriages where the women would remain with their parents or, as I understand, with their husbands away from the Smith household. And he was put in this position of making visits, conjugal visits, if you will, to his wives in different parts of the Illinois area. Benjamin F. Johnson records in his diaries Joseph Smith and William Clayton coming to Macedonia, Illinois, and making a visit to his daughter Almira. There were other records of this visiting, and you can see how that would become necessary. So this is one way in which it changed his life. It was a very unusual life because he was being hunted by the sheriff. He was announcing revelations. He was running. He was marrying. It was an added complication to his life. But ultimately, the prospect of the plural marriages changed his life by taking his life. One of his wives was involved in a lawsuit. This was Maria Lawrence. In 1844, William Law brought Joseph Smith to court on the charge of adultery or bigamy. I'm not sure which it is, Todd, but he was accused of an improper relationship with a young woman, not his wife, and there were court proceedings that were beginning at the same time the Nauvoo Expositor, which was written in part by some of Joseph's associates in the church leadership, announced his practice of plural marriage. He ended up being part of an effort to destroy the newspaper, and the state of Illinois moved in. He was arrested, jailed, and killed. And so how did this affect his life? Well, it ended badly. He lost his life in 1844. But the practice of plural marriage, which he had initiated, or we might say restored, based upon the Hebrew example, which he discovered while translating the Bible, or retranslating, and formed his own translation of the Bible. He noticed the Hebrew patriarchs with plural wives. If you use the word restored, he restored that, and then after his death, that was brought from Illinois across the plains to Utah, and it remains in Utah and surrounding states, Canada, different places today. I don't know what the number of plural husbands and wives are, plural families. I understand it may be currently in the 30,000 area, maybe it's more or less, I just don't know. But that was certainly one of the results. How did it change his life? I should say, how did it change the life of all those who followed him? I probably should let Todd respond, but I just want to, there's probably one question in your mind, and that's, how do we know all this? I mean, we know how they met. I told you how they met, staying in their homes. But how do you know he married them? Well, we wouldn't know if it weren't for one thing, and that is when the saints moved west from Nauvoo to the Great Salt Lake, which was then in Mexico, leaving in 1846, the family of Joseph Smith did not leave. His mother, his wife, his children remained in the east. And as
this schism, if you will, developed. Joseph's wife insisted that he had never practiced plural marriage, that it was Brigham Young who invented the idea. It was a terrible idea, and we are disassociated with it. And there was a little bit of angry exchange of he did, he didn't, one of those head-to-head sorts of things. And Joseph F. Smith collected affidavits of as many of the wives of Joseph Smith that he could. In, I guess it was 1869, he collected numerous affidavits which are in the possession of church archives. And they're very brief, but they come from all these women: Lucinda, Sylvia, Patty, Sarah, Elizabeth, Delsina, Eliza. I, in fact, did marry the prophet sometimes on this date. We did live together as husband and wife. These affidavits are confirmed often by witnesses, their parents, their friends, other wives cross-affirm the marriages of these other women. And with these affidavits, letters were written by the Mormon leadership in Utah to Joseph Smith's family back in the Midwest, affirming and attempting to prove Joseph's marriage in a polygamous way. And of course, you know, when somebody argues with you and pushes you against the wall, you say, "I'm not going to believe it anyway." And that happened for a long time. I think there's been some common understanding that this is the case, though, that the formerly RLDS Church does accept that Joseph Smith did have these plural wives. But interestingly enough, in 1887, the assistant church historian Andrew Jensen took a number of these affidavits and he published them in something he was writing called the Historical Record. And so these are not just affidavits in a vault, but these are affidavits recorded in this book and in Joseph Fielding Smith's a small book called Blood Atonement and the Origin of Plural Marriage. And with the recording of these, this preserved this for people like Todd and myself and others to be able to verify these plural marriages. We wouldn't have known this because in 1890, of course, with the U.S. government putting pressure on the corporation of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, there was a manifesto, a rescission of the practice of polygamy officially, officially in 1904, and the church itself turned its posture to restrain and to eliminate polygamy within its official membership. And this stress still maintains. But the whole interest in finding plural wives has dissipated. And it's only a scholar like Todd Compton who will, you know, spend hours in the libraries and finding letters and checking the affidavits that we do have this information. I guess I should close now, and I know he's not going to say it, but you really do need to see his book. That's the best series of 33 biographies of these wives of Joseph Smith. Thank you very much.
I want to thank George for those kind words, and just say how much I admire what he's done through Signature Books over the years. And as I've said before, Signature Books have increased my faith. You know, I find them very faith-promoting in the highest way. You know, like I believe that anything true builds authentic faith. So I just wanted to make a couple notes and then talk about some more general things. George did not make a mistake when he talked about Mary Elizabeth Rollins Leitner, but other people have, so I just wanted to clarify some things that he touched on. First of all, you know, sometimes you get these conservative folklore rumors, then you also get liberal folklore rumors. And one of the liberal folklore things about
Mary Elizabeth Rollins was that Joseph Smith married her when she was, or proposed to her when she was 10 or 11, something like that. And according to my research, that's completely incorrect. And the ceiling she had when she was a young girl, where she felt she was sealed to Joseph Smith, he and other early members of the church were going around to congregations and sealing them up to eternal life. And so she was a part of one of these congregations when he sealed them up to eternal life. And so it was very different from what we eventually came to understand as marriage sealings in Nauvoo. Okay. Later, when she was talking about her marriage to Joseph Smith in Nauvoo, and I believe that's when she, all the evidence that I've seen shows that that's where she married Joseph Smith, was in Nauvoo in, I forget the date, what was it, 1842? That doesn't matter. Anyway, when Joseph Smith married her, and
February of 1842.
Okay. When Joseph Smith married her, he, she left very interesting accounts of how Joseph Smith proposed to her, and, but one of the few polyandrous plural wives who did leave an account of how Joseph Smith proposed to her. But when he proposed to her, he said, you know, way back in Missouri, I felt that the Lord inspired me to marry you, you know, but you were far, you know, you were 500 miles away. So I didn't. But that was Joseph Smith looking back. And in 1841 telling her that he'd kind of had this impression to marry her, but he hadn't, I don't believe he even proposed to her at that time. So Joseph Smith did not marry Mary Elizabeth Rollins when she was 11. Okay, and so he waited until February 1842. And George did not make that mistake, but other people have, so I just wanted to clarify that. When I wrote my book, I really focused on the viewpoint of the 33 plural wives. And I could not do that without every now and then mentioning Joseph Smith. However, I did not analyze in any extended way how Joseph Smith did his polygamy. I did not focus on Joseph Smith. When I finished writing the biographies, or one draft of the biographies, a friend of mine suggested that there were some things that were so odd in there that people would not understand, like the polyandry, Joseph Smith marrying women who were married to other men, and the women staying with other men while they were married to Joseph Smith. It would be a good idea if I had some kind of introduction to explain some of those things. So I did do that quite small introduction, you know. I mean, I could have done it would be easy to do a 300-page book on focusing on Joseph Smith and how Joseph Smith arranged his plural wives in Nauvoo. And I did a very small introduction that I felt was necessary to understand the plural wives. And George is moving beyond that to actually look more at Joseph Smith. And so his look at how he knew these plural wives before he married them, I think, is very, very interesting. And a different perspective than my book, though. So a lot of the things he talks about do come through in my book, because they're part of the lives of these women. I think one generalization that struck me as he was going through this is that he was very charismatic. I think how he got these women, very intelligent women, to follow him, and their families often to follow him in this very non-normative form of marriage. I think it shows how very charismatic he was. And of course, charisma is a very ambiguous thing, so that's kind of a non-loaded statement, but I think we can. It's kind of a loaded, well, I mean, you can interpret charisma two ways, negative or positive, but however you interpret, I think you have to agree that
He was charismatic. George, when he was talking about this paper, he suggested I plug my new book and talk about how I'm a Whitney. So I'll do that a little bit, leading into the subject he's talking about. My new book will be The Diaries of Helen Marr Kimball Smith Whitney. And she, of course, was the daughter of Heber C. Kimball, and she was the one who married Joseph Smith when she was 14. And the book I'm doing is far away from Nauvoo. It's in Salt Lake City, and the years are 1884 to 1896. So it's just a whole different perspective than you have in Nauvoo, and we're coming to the end of polygamy in those years. And we're coming to the end of Helen Marr Whitney's life. We know her well as this 14-year-old in Nauvoo, and in the diaries that will be published hopefully this year, we'll see her as an older woman, as a widow, as a mother, as a grandmother. It's a fascinating document. And she kept very faithful diary entries in her later life. She said her father encouraged her to keep a diary when she was young, but she didn't want to, but later in her life she felt a need to, and she had many problems. She had health problems. She had problems with her family, and I think her diary is therapeutic for her. So look for that. There's also, it's a very fascinating document about polygamy. And there's a lot about Heber C. Kimball's plural wives and his family, a lot about the Whitney family. Emmeline Wells was a Whitney. And the children of Sarah Ann Whitney appear in these diaries. And so it's a fascinating document of the sunset of polygamy. So I thought I would look briefly at Helen's story to see how it relates to how Joseph Smith obtained at least this plural wife. So Helen was 14, and she wrote an autobiographical record of how she was approached to become a plural wife. And according to her, her father had a great desire to be linked with Joseph Smith through a sealing, through a plural marriage. And so at least according to that evidence, the idea came from Heber C. Kimball. And, you know, you never know. They might have talked about it loosely before, but according to that evidence, it came through Heber C. Kimball. So this was, we can definitely call this a dynastic marriage in which two prominent church families were linked through the marriage of a daughter of one of the members. However, I think with all marriages, motivation can be very complex. And all kinds of factors, if you remember on your own marriage, if you're married, all kinds of factors come into consideration. And so even if two families like each other and want to be linked, there's nothing that makes it impossible that the two people are not attracted to each other. So, because it's a dynastic marriage, I don't rule out spiritual attraction between Joseph Smith and Helen Marr Whitney, and I don't rule out physical attraction. In the polemics of dealing with polygamy, some people say, "Oh, it's all sexual." Other people say, "Oh, there is absolutely no sexuality at all." And I see nothing wrong with complex motivations, including sexual attraction, including spiritual attraction, including dynastic considerations. So her father approached her and said, and introduced her to the subject of plural marriage, and then in the same session he said, "Now, would you like to marry Joseph Smith?" Here's this 14-year-old girl, and Joseph Smith was in his early 30s, and you know, I'm sure she saw him as someone, you know, almost over the hill, and as well as a church leader who she revered. So this was an incredible shock to her. She calls it an earthquake, and she strongly reacted against the idea of polygamy. So her father continued talking with her, and
Not long after that, I think the next day, Joseph Smith talked to her, and he told her that the salvation of her and her family depended on her becoming, you know, taking this marriage to him. And so, faced with this, she said, "Okay, I'll do it." And the Vorait, Heber's wife, was having a big struggle with polygamy at the time, and according to Helen's autobiography, she said to her, "Well, Heber and Joseph said, 'Well, what do you think, Vorait?'" And you can just see Vorait struggling with it and saying, "Well, if she says it's okay, it's okay." So I think it was very painful for Vorait. And so soon after that, Helen Mar Whitney was married to Joseph Smith. And I think it, I don't have my book with me, but I think it was, all this was within a 48-hour period. So there wasn't a lot of courting, wasn't a lot of preparation for Helen Mar Whitney. And in, again, in the polemics of the history of polygamy, one big issue is, was there sexuality after this marriage? And my stand on this is, I have not found any evidence either way, for or against. So my best guess is that, based on parallels from Utah, is that there was no sexual dimension to this marriage. But again, there's no evidence either way. That's just my best guess. So that's an example of a dynastic marriage where Joseph Smith worked through the father, where the father was possibly the one who started the idea. As a contrast, we could look at Lucy Walker. And what happened with Lucy Walker is, instead of Joseph Smith working through her father, he sent the father on a mission. And so he proposed to Lucy Walker when the father was far away on a mission. And so, you know, again, it's just impossible to say what were the motivations. Was this just a standard mission? And then when Mr. Walker was gone, then Joseph Smith had the desire to marry Lucy? Or is it possible that he thought, well, he will not agree to this, you know, and it's the right thing, so I'll send him on a mission to smooth it, smooth the way? And you might say, well, what evidence do you have, Todd, for, you know, Joseph Smith having that kind of idea and arranging things in this way? Well, I do have a little bit of evidence from Sarah Ann Whitney. And it wasn't with her father. That was another very dynastic marriage where he worked with the father and the mother. However, Joseph Smith felt that Sarah Ann Whitney's older brother, Horace, who later became the plural wife, the husband of the earthly husband of Helen Mar Kimball Smith Whitney, he thought Horace might object to the marriage to Sarah Ann. And again, Sarah Ann was a teen, and so he sent Horace on a mission, and we have good documentation for that. So we know that he could send, you know, he would consciously send people on missions if he felt they might oppose his polygamy. So Lucy Walker was approached by Joseph Smith while her father was away, and she, after a struggle, she accepted this marriage and was married to Joseph Smith. And when the father came back, Joseph Smith checked with him, and the father agreed after it was done. And so this is kind of in the pattern of Joseph Smith marrying young women whose fathers were not present, either dead or absent. And so I think that's an important pattern. I don't know exactly what George is going to do with it, but it's something that I think he will be looking at and should be looked at carefully. And again, it's ambiguous. You could look at it positively, you could look at it negatively. As you could look at the number of cases where he married young women who were living in his house. And they had a very close, you know, the Partridge sisters had a very close relationship with Emma. They looked at Emma and Joseph as father and mother figures, almost. So these are very ambiguous, interesting relationships. And
Okay. And I think at this time I've come to the end of my comments, and I look forward to George's book, and thank you.
We're just about out of time. I'd like to make a couple of quick comments. After Todd's book came out and people began reading it, one of the main complaints, if you want to call it that, of the book is, how could Joseph Smith take other men's wives? And this is a disturbing thing, I'm sure, maybe to all of us. And I certainly can't answer the question for everybody, but I did come to some decisions of my own. Number one, I have a very strong testimony that Joseph Smith is a prophet of God. I had to base it on that. Then he at one time made a statement, I cannot tell you 1/100th part of what I know. Maybe this is some of the thing, maybe the 99% that he couldn't tell. I think we have to be careful not judging somebody until we have all the facts, and we certainly don't have all the facts in this case. Maybe he made commitments with these women in the pre-existence. Maybe the law of adoption has something to do with this, which was practiced at that time, men to men. There's a lot of things that we know so little about. In my heart, it does not bother me that he took other men's wives. There was a reason for it. We may not understand it now, but I think we need to be careful in not criticizing a great man like Joseph Smith for some of those things. We have time maybe for two or three quick questions. Let's keep them to as briefly as possible.
I noticed that there is a pattern of a man who is involved in plural marriage, sometimes marrying both a mother and a daughter, and that is strictly against Jewish law. How did they justify this, since they were looking back at the old biblical practice of plural marriage as practiced by early Jews?
That's a good question, because with that apparent violation of Jewish law and the Mormon faith going back as being a new restoration of the original church, which goes back to Jewish times, that does sound like a conflict. I think what they did was they were also marrying in anticipation of crossing the plains, and every woman was meant to be associated with some man and be some organization in a wagon train. And quite often, sisters, mothers were involved. There may be something else that I don't know. Do you know anything else, Todd, about that?
Yeah.
And I think today, under not Jewish law, that would be a raise eyebrows. There is some evidence of children. It's not really hard evidence. Todd, do you want to...
go ahead.
Well, Josephina, I don't think... there's maybe just... I think in looking over Michael's research, I think he comes up with about 6 or 7 or 8 possible children, and it's sort of family conversations that suggest that. There was a definite interest in not announcing children. It was an illegal practice. Many of the women lived with their families. Many of the children would be raised, if there were children, under another family name.
Fisher, Sylvia Sessions,
yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's one affidavit in the from Sylvia Sessions' daughter her mother told her that she was a daughter of Joseph Smith. That's the only thing that's legal in an affidavit sort of way. Do you know any other thing that's definite like that?
Mary Elizabeth Leitner said that she knew of a number of children raised under other names.
So Todd is saying Mary Elizabeth Leitner said she knew of a number of other children raised under other names. Yeah. So nothing specific. Vicki?
Was it
Huntington
who said she wasn't sure if her child was Joseph Smith or Mrs. Jewell?
I don't know if she said that or if Fawn Brody took the photograph and compared them, and they look very similar, Joseph Smith and her. Sure.
This probably is better be our last comment if it's time to quit.
This is Vicki Adams.
Eastman,
sorry.
Thanks, Lord.
Vicki Stewart Eastman.
I've been thinking about this a long time, you know, why these odd marriages took place. And I really think that they did not think of marriage in those days in the same terms that we think of it today. I think the primary goal of marriage in those days was as a salvation tool, not as a tool for forming a nuclear family like we see it. And that is why many women went into it, even though they were married to another man. Because if you felt that this was a way of assuring your salvation, you know, you would make decisions differently than if it was just a marriage in a conventional sense. So I think that from our point of view, indoctrinated as we are, that a temple sealing is a marriage forever, and that what we are trying to do these days is form a nuclear family with a mother and father and children. I don't think that was their goal then. I think their goal in that time was to gather a group of people together who were going to go into salvation as a group. And for that kind of a goal, you would make unusual arrangements. That's what I think.
Okay, thank you very much.